Hello and welcome to the Interior Design Business. My name is Susie Rumbold. I'm the Creative Director of Tesuto Interiors and a past President of the British Institute of Interior Design. And today we're exploring Passive House for interior designers in the company of award-winning design firm, the Vawdrey House. A Passive House is any building, new or retrofitted, that achieves the highest certifiable standard of energy efficiency while using negligible fuel for heating and cooling. As the planet warms, this is clearly where we should all be heading. But Passive Houses are not without their detractors who claim that these buildings are boxy, stuffy, and chilly. And is it enough for a building to be Passive House, or does this still leave us a million miles away from achieving a truly sustainable built environment? What is the truth behind the hype, and is it possible to take a conventionally built 1990s house and turn it into a paragon of stylish sustainability? Welcome to the Interior Design Business. Today, we're joined by Jennifer Hamilton and Ian Chapman, founders and co-directors of BIID award-winning architecture and design practice, the Vawdrey House, to explore these issues through the lens of a recent project. Jenny and Ian, please, will you introduce yourselves and your company?
Hi, Susie. I'm Jenny Hamilton. My personal background and training is in interior design, and I did sort of 10 or so years in commercial interior design before I founded the Vawdrey House 13 years ago. We now work on a mix of both high-end residential and commercial projects, but with a strong focus on combining the architecture and the interior design from the outset.
Hi, Susie. I'm Ian Chapman. I am director at the Vawdrey House. I'm an RIBA chartered architect, and Jenny and I worked alongside each other through the Vawdrey House. As Jenny says, we combine and specialise in combining, I think, architecture and interior design. And we do so seamlessly from the outset of a project. It's a little bit different to how traditionally the industry works, but we think we make a good success of it. And like Jenny says, we're combining not only architecture and interiors, but commercial and residential projects as well, and everything in influences everything else. So our commercial spaces have a domestic sensibility and our residential projects have a really professional commercial rigor.
So you're a one-stop shop for clients. That sounds brilliant. Ian, what do we mean when we talk about passive houses?
When we talk about passive houses, we're talking about houses that have been designed for the goal of achieving very, very minimal energy consumption in use. So a lot of work goes on up front to understand the form of the building and the makeup of the construction and the thermal envelope of that building, the levels of insulation and the levels of air tightness that are required to achieve that. We work to sort of five key principles when we're designing passive houses. Number one, really, really good levels of insulation, clearly massively important to make sure that that thermal envelope is as efficient as possible. With that, very, very high performance triple glazed windows. And obviously very, very well installed. Very high levels of air tightness. So again, focusing on the building envelope to make sure that there are no drafts and leaks in the construction. We design out or seek to design out overheating as much as possible. So carrying out assessments to make sure that big areas of south-facing glazing have overshading. And incorporation of an MVHR system, mechanical ventilation and heat recovery system. Those five key principles together are about investing in the building fabric before we deal with anything else. It's called a sort of fabric first approach.
And where did the passive house movement come from? What were its origins?
Its origins go back 35 years now. A group of physicists in Germany recognizing energy crisis, an impending sustainability crisis, an environmental crisis, realized that housing stock, in particular, it was focused on housing initially, housing stock, very, very energy inefficient. If we're going to have fewer and more expensive fossil fuels, lack of energy availability, lack of energy security, a way to address that, the best way to address that is at the root cause. How much energy does that home need in the first place?
Is passive house, is it only for new builds or can it apply to retrofit projects as well?
If we think of passive house as a series of principles that enable us to design buildings with very low energy consumption, then yes, it can be applied to retrofit projects as much as it can to new build projects. Traditionally, typically, and historically, it is more associated with new build projects. it is a slightly easier, let's say, thing to do to build new to Passive House principles and achieve certification standards than it is to do so with retrofit and refurbishment projects.
Yeah, and I'm guessing it must be far tougher to achieve those Passive House standards with a refurbishment, because the existing elements that make up the shell of the building are beyond your control. Is there a separate accreditation standard for retrofit projects?
There is. It's a slightly separate accreditation standard. It's run by the Passive House Institute as well, and it's called ENERFIT. It does take a slightly different approach to the calculations that go on in the background.
Interesting. Now, I know from our recent conversations that your particular Passive House project was in fact a retrofit. So for the benefit of our listeners, can you please give us just a really quick overview of what was the building you were working on?
It was sort of 1985 built, I think, sort of executive home, really, in Wimbledon. Not particularly interesting to look at, if I'm honest. Yellow brick, brown windows, sort of two stories with a garage. And internally, really, it was just a lot of plasterboard and carpet with fairly low ceilings. Outside was a really sloping garden. But the best thing about it, and the reason that the client wanted to stay and refurbish it rather than just move somewhere else, was the surprisingly quiet location down a little side road, and also incredible views from the back where the hill sloped away. The house was left looking across the rooftops and right out over sort of Wimbledon and the Epsom Downs, I think.
Had they lived there for a long time?
At least 10 years they've been there. They had been there. The project had been in the making for quite some time. You know, the client was really keen to do this and had sort of looked at various ways to refurbish the house with some other architects and with, in fact, a Passive House specialist at one point, which was to create a new build. The idea had been to knock it down. They got planning for that and they were going to build a new build Passive House. But in the end, she felt that, you know, the actual negative carbon impact of taking the building away, she couldn't really reconcile with herself, and actually felt that it was a perfectly good bones of a building that hadn't been there very long. And actually she would much rather attempt to create the same standards of a Passive House, but using the old building.
Because that was going to be my next question, was actually, wouldn't it have been easier to simply demolish the existing house? You know, if you demolish it, clear the site and start from scratch, surely you can achieve those standards with greater ease.
Yeah, it's a very difficult point, very interesting point. It probably would have been easier in many senses, but if you're solely trying to achieve a Passive House standard and that is your only measure of sustainable design, then yes, it probably would have been easier to knock it down and start again. But as Jenny says, there's other issues at play, aren't there?
Passive House enthusiasts talk a lot about something called the form factor of a building. What is the form factor and how is it calculated, and what would be considered an ideal form factor?
The form factor is, think of the building as we often call it the thermal envelope, the skin around the outside of the building, the roof, the walls, the floor, the windows and the doors. And obviously with inside that envelope is the internal spaces. So the ratio between the internal floor area and the external thermal envelope, that ratio is the form factor. A building designed to achieve a very good form factor minimizes the extent of the thermal envelope relative to the internal floor area. So unsurprisingly, I suppose, blocks of flats, apartments in flats make for a very, very, very good form factor, very, very limited area of thermal envelope. A project like ours, a refurbishment project, the form factor is a very tricky aspect to have any control over in the design development. We're dealing with an existing building. There are other constraints in place. There's planning. There is the form of the existing building. There is view, aspect, orientation. The amount that you can add in certain areas is very controlled and influenced by all those other factors. So solving entirely for form factor with existing buildings is very, very difficult.
So what would be considered ideal? So it's the lower the number.
Exactly. You're trying to minimize the extent of thermal envelope relative to internal floor area. So houses with walls that cut in and out all over the place, dormers on roofs, bay windows, all add to, you can imagine, the extent of the thermal envelope relative to the internal floor area. And obviously, the more thermal envelope you have, the harder that thermal envelope has to work to keep the internal spaces warm. And when we're dealing with passive houses, at the pinnacle of energy efficiency, maximizing our insulation is really, really important. Where it is a useful tool is it does give a bit of a more intelligent approach to insulation levels within the thermal envelope rather than a blanket U value application.
So you mentioned blocks of flats, and I guess that's why passive houses have tended to have had a reputation for being boxy, because I suppose if you've got low ceilings, lots of floor levels, you know, like a block, that's going to be the most efficient from a passive house perspective, but it's not necessarily going to be the most aesthetic. Do you know what the baseline form factor of the house was before you started working on it?
No, I don't think we actually calculated it. As I say, our brief to develop the building wasn't influenced by minimizing the form factor.
So, and do you have you any idea what you ended up achieving, or is that also not terribly relevant?
No, we do, because we know the floor area, we know the thermal envelope area from all the calculations that went on in the development of the design. So our form factor, I think, is over 4.4, which is quite high. And you can imagine why, when you see the building, it is not a boxy passive house.
No, exactly. Now, passive house buildings, I know, are super airtight because that eliminates drafts and heat loss. They use something called mechanical ventilation and heat recovery systems, which is often abbreviated to MVHR, to maintain the indoor air quality. How does this work? And did you install an MVHR system in this particular project?
Yes, we did. And actually, we do them more and more now. In once you get beyond a certain level of refurbishment, it's starting to make sense in a larger house across other sort of types of projects. But in layman's terms, this basically keeps your sort of flow of fresh air going and cleverly exchanges the warm, stuffy air for the cool, fresh air, but heats it up, steals the heat from the old air and heats up the new air. So you keep a sort of general ambient temperature while changing the air over. So opening a window without getting cold, basically. In sort of older houses, you generally you get your fresh air through a system of leaks and gaps, don't you? You've got sort of drafty windows and trickle vents and cat flaps and letterboxes and fireplaces and chimneys. And even if you kept all your windows shut, you've got a reasonable amount of fresh air just generally leaking in and out all the time. But once you start to make the building fully airtight, you need to look at how that fresh air is going to get in. Otherwise, you're just breathing your own breath.
And I know these systems, I know they remove carbon dioxide, bad smells, VOCs, and humidity. Which of these four nasties is the one that's most detrimental to human health?
I mean, they've all got their issues, I suppose, apart from bad smells, which are just unpleasant and things that it's nice to know you're not going to have. But, you know, carbon dioxide, we're breathing out all the time. And as I say, most of the time that leaks its way out and isn't too much of a problem. But in a really airtight home, and if you had a gas fire burning, for example, a gas stove burning or a fire, that could really build up and you would have potential for sort of fatigue, headaches, respiratory issues. And, you know, I mean, obviously, eventually, if all you breathe is carbon dioxide, you can suffocate. And humidity would give you issues with condensation and mold eventually. That can lead to, again, respiratory illnesses, and it can even damage your gut microbiomes and things like that within you and over time, apparently. So sort of lastly, I think the VOCs are being linked to more issues every day, actually. And that stands for volatile organic compounds, for anyone that doesn't know. They certainly cause sort of respiratory problems, dizziness, headaches. They can aggravate asthma, allergies. And, you know, some, such as formaldehyde, for example, can even cause cancer. And this is, you know, what my client was particularly interested in, as she had recently survived breast cancer a few years before. So, you know, part of key central to her brief really was cutting that out, both by removing it with the MVHR, but by not bringing them in the first place.
And how tricky are these MVHR systems to design and install? What factors do you need to account for when you're putting one of these together?
As with all mechanical systems, like air conditioning included, a key is early specialist design and careful coordination early on to get them within the interiors properly. You need to think about space for ducting, perhaps more so than anything else, because you've got to bring that return and supply to every single room all around the house. And then all of this ductwork has got to weave its way back to one single point for the heat exchanger. So that can add up to an awful lot running through. So sometimes you want a larger floor void or ceiling void in order to allow that to happen, so that they're not coming up against, you know, hopping steels, hopping joists, hopping other ducts, doing other things. It can be really, really congested in those spaces. Depends on the type of duct. You can get a kind of flat oblong one that is a bit smoother, and that our client preferred those because she felt that that would give even less chance for those ducts themselves to then harbour condensation or dust over time. The sort of full size ones are about 150 and sort of, as you say, a big sort of nest really going through. You obviously need to look at the grill locations and the grill types. It's not just a case of design them in where you want them. They've got to be balanced. They've got to sit in the right places in the room. So you need to work closely with people so that you don't get things where you don't want them in the end. And you've got to maintain a little bit of flow between the rooms as well. So you actually have to undercut the doors a bit so that you don't end up with a sort of suction between rooms once every extract is running.
I have a mental picture of someone not being able to open the door because of the sucking going in on the other side. I think you've just touched on the answer to my next question, actually. I was going to ask you, what are the likely effects of a poorly designed and installed system? But I suppose some of these nasties getting trapped in pockets within the ducting system must be a hazard.
Yeah, that is a hazard. You're absolutely right. The main thing to be concerned about when it comes to a poorly designed system is that it's not doing its job properly. These things need to work very efficiently. And if it is not well designed, if the duct runs are too long, if the vents are not positioned in the right places, if the grills are not positioned in the right places, then it's not going to do what you need it to do. And what it's doing is removing humidity, removing condensation, removing those nasties that we've talked about.
Yeah. The other thing that we were looking at on site is you need to be very careful that the site team cover it up as they install it, because it's one of the first fixes that go in. And obviously, if all the pipe works are open-ended, you've got that filling up with plaster dust for the whole sort of purpose of for the whole duration of the job. So sealing up both ends once the ducts are in place and making sure that that's all carefully flushed at the end as well is really important. Otherwise, you're making the problem worse.
So I'm guessing from that perspective, you must be working with contractors who are experienced in passive house construction.
Yes, certainly. You can't approach it without some experience. It requires care, attention to detail, focus, experience, knowledge of the materials. It is not something to be taken on lightly. And certainly if you are aiming to achieve a level of certification, then, it needs very experienced contractors.
Yeah. I'm guessing from that then that passive houses are more expensive to build or refurbish than homes that are just perhaps built to our normal current UK building regs?
Yes, inevitably, yeah. They require greater levels of insulation, greater levels of control on site, airtightness membranes that aren't necessarily required to just meet building regulations. They are a level above, for sure.
Any idea how much more? What would we be talking, 10%, 20%?
I couldn't say, actually, Susie. What's interesting, of course, is whether or not the premium that you pay at the build is worth it in the long run for the massively reduced running costs.
Yeah, yes. And I can imagine there would be a sort of payback period, which if you had skeptical clients, it could potentially be possible to even calculate, if they're intending to be in this house for 10, 20 years, that it would pay back within a decade, say, just as an example, given how expensive energy is.
It's certainly possible to calculate. And a lot of the design work that goes on up front is about knowing exactly what the energy consumption of the house will be going forward. What's hard to predict, of course, is what the energy cost is.
MVHR systems, I think, they're usually set to run at about 20 degrees centigrade. Some people find that that's a bit cold. Can a home be run at a slightly warmer temperature and still be a passive house?
A passive house can be run at whatever temperature the occupants find comfortable. The MVHR system is extracting the warm, stale air and supplying preheated fresh air. So it's not the heating for the space. So our passive houses will have underfloor heating, and that heating will be generated by usually an air source heat pump. So you can run the house to whatever temperature you find comfortable. The MVHR will supply air at about, if it's extracting air from the house and the house is at about 20, 21 degrees, the heat exchangers are so efficient that the air that's blown back in, that's sucked in from the outside fresh air, even on a 5-6 degree day outside, that air can come in at about 17, 18 degrees. So it does a huge amount for us in terms of space heating, but you still require underfloor heating or maybe even radiators, depending on the house.
No, that's interesting, because I think that kind of debunks one of the other reputational issues that passive houses suffer from, is that they're cold, that people don't find them comfortable.
It's interesting as well, because a lot of the time, because of the nature of what a client is trying to achieve with a passive house, very, very low energy consumption, you might be naturally inclined to turn the thermostat down.
And put on another sweater, exactly. Yeah. How did you manage some of these issues within your designs for this particular project? I mean, Ian, you touched on insulation, but what about things like existing wall thicknesses?
Clearly, with the purpose of the project, retaining as much of the existing building fabric as possible meant that we had to get a good understanding of what the existing building fabric was and therefore what the best treatment is for that fabric to bring it up to Passive House standards. So here we were dealing with a 1990s built cavity wall construction, not a very big cavity, not any insulation in that existing cavity. We needed to then look at adding a significant layer of insulation. We added that to the exterior of the building, so wrapping it in a big woolly jumper, basically.
Amazing.
And then blue insulation inside that cavity as well to give us a little bit more. But yeah, we had to work carefully to understand what we had as an existing fabric and then what we could do sensitively to do it, how that would affect the appearance of the building clearly is a major concern. What implications there might be for loss of space internally. You might consider applying that insulation on the inside skin, but that's a significant loss of floor space. And then what it does for the building physics, how is moisture traveling through those walls? What is going on in terms of waterproofing and vapor control?
And so you applied a big woolly jumper to the outside of the building. And I think then you put some sort of, like timber cladding on top of that again? What sort of thickness did you add onto the outside in the end?
That's right. There was almost 200 millimetres of insulation applied over the external skin. But one of the things that was a challenge from the outset of the project was managing overheating. It's a south-facing rear garden, and the client obviously wanted to have lots of glazing onto that garden to take in the very best of those views. That is slightly counter to a lot of the Passive House principles of trying to minimise heat gain through the windows. So we worked carefully with our consultants to model overheating risk, understand where external shading devices would be needed to prevent that overheating, understanding where to put overhangs. So the big rear glazing that runs across the back of the house at the ground floor that takes in the kitchen space and the dining and the living has an external cover, runs over a veranda deck, if you like, at the back of the house. And that shields that glazing from the highest sun in the summer.
Oh, that's a nice idea too. That's fabulous. If the Passive House principle is a set of standards applied to the building shell, which is what we've been talking about, is it possible for a Passive House to be unsustainable in other ways?
Well, for sure, I think so. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, sustainable and unsustainable, obviously really broad terms and freely applied to all sorts of things for all sorts of different purposes. Passive House principles, designed to Passive House standards, Passive House certification, is empirical, it's scientific, it's numbers based. So you can say my house achieves Passive House standard or not, and we all know where we are standing with that. But it is only concerned really with energy consumption in use. That's its primary driver. It takes the certification standards, take a nod towards how that energy that is required in use is generated, but it makes no assessment of carbon in raw materials. It makes no assessment of biodiversity. It makes no assessment of how much tropical hardwood you've sourced for your joinery. There are other issues at play, clearly.
Is it tricky to use only sustainable materials and still achieve Passive House standards? And were there times on your project when this created conflicts between using the right thing and achieving the right standard?
Yeah, for sure. A very efficient insulation that might perform really, really well is not necessarily going to meet the other criteria on the project of low VOC, not petrochemical derived. That was certainly an issue that we faced. We would have rather used natural insulation materials, but they would have been much, much thicker, taken up much more space, changed the characteristics of the building. If we were to use a mineral wall, say, on the flat roof, that would have been thicker than a PR insulation would have been. So here we were constrained by the form of the building and the height that we could extend for planning purposes. So we had to accept a compromise there and used a PIR insulation where we'd have ideally not placed that outside the roof, outside the building thermal envelope, outside the air tightness layer. So the risk in terms of VOCs was diminished for the client. Similar problem in the ground. There are very, very few, if any, materials that are suitable below ground level for insulation that aren't polystyrene.
Right, yeah, which is a nasty. So should the passive house standard always take precedence, do you think, over the materials?
It really depends on, I think, the client. Like any project, what we're trying to do is understand what's important to the client, to the building user. What is their concern? Sustainability is a broad topic. It has many different arms and aspects to it. What are we designing for? Are we trying to source local materials primarily? Are we trying to reduce energy consumption in use? Are we trying to minimize carbon use? And like we've been discussing, I think, today, there isn't one route that answers all of these things. So it's about understanding what's important within that particular project and to that particular client.
Yeah. And I suppose if you're using perhaps a less than ideal product, but it's going into a building where it's going to stay there for a long time, then actually you've kind of bitten the carbon bullet at that point and you're not going to be creating any more.
The impact of in use versus the impact at construction. That building's going to run unrefurbished, say, for 50 years. The energy saving over that 50 years is massive in comparison to if it were constructed another way.
Yeah. Now, the interior. What were the client's goals for the interior of the building?
I would say it's you know, just as on the outside, the clients were keen to strike a balance between the performance of the building, top quality design. You know, that was absolutely central to her brief from the start. Is she didn't want that boxy passive house that, you know, she was really setting out to dispel those sort of rumors as you set them out at the beginning. And at the same time, she wanted to look at, you know, responsibly sourcing everything that went into it as well. And I think responsibly sourcing is probably a good way to sort of frame it, because it doesn't necessarily mean eco-friendly. You know, it means just, it doesn't have to be a recycled product necessarily, but at each point of the decision process, we just assessed various criteria, and, you know, the environmental credentials were reviewed at each point, looking at their effect right across the process. So from the production stages, both the effects on the environment at production, but also the personnel in the manufacturing process. She was really interested in that. If it was something that wasn't necessarily going to affect her, but might have caused problems in the factory for the people working with the materials, she didn't really want to get involved in that. The materials used themselves, whether they're, you know, recycled or recyclable, delivery, how far it's coming, and then in use, obviously, this where the VOCs come in and what the material is going to be like to use, how hard wearing is it? Because even though it might be, you know, fantastic on a lot of other things, if it's going to fall apart in 5 minutes, then actually you've just got to get another one. So that's working. And then looking right down to the end of its life, when it has finished, when they move out or somebody wants to strip it out, what happens then? Is there some sort of forward plan and that kind of thing for the product? So there's so many aspects here. And I think what we found is there's really very, very few that will tick all of those boxes. So it's about just assessing each case, what your brief is, you know, finding the one that you like, doing your best to find the best approach in each case. And it will always be different. You know, each case has to be assessed individually until there's a system where everyone goes through some rigorous process and gets a stamp, when all you need to do is choose everything that's got stamp number one and off you go. I think that's a long way off, really, that kind of assessment level. And so you just need to sort of look into it. And then, of course, you've also got to choose whether you like it. Just like any other design project, you still go, well, here are your three choices. Oh, I don't, they're not really working for me. It's just the same as with any other product. So you know, there was a lot of stuff at play in the design process. I'd probably say one of the number one things was the air quality, so the VOCs within the home.
So your sourcing, your product library must have changed significantly as a result of doing this exercise. You must now be kind of a world authority on where everything has come from and its properties.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because there's quite a lot of paradoxes as well, looking at these from these different angles. So there's many, many products we looked at which on the one hand were eco-friendly, so for example, made of recycled materials. But then often once they have been recycled once, that might mean you can't recycle them again. So it doesn't tick your box for end of life. Or we were looking at another product that was recycled glass for a work surface. And, you know, we were thinking, oh, this is fabulous because glass is recyclable again as well. So this all works. But actually, there was a sort of the client was a little bit worried about it and wasn't keen because some of the recycled glass could contain recycled cathode ray tubes from old TVs and monitors, which have inherent sort of toxic elements such as lead, cadmium, and mercury. So she was really keen to avoid any risk of that coming into the house. So it sort of put a whole category out on that basis as well. So when you start stacking up all of these things together, it's really, really hard to get all of them ticked.
What were your clients' other main criteria when sourcing for the interior? And how did you go about fulfilling those criteria?
Well, I think it did vary by item. As I said, not everything ticks every box, of course. And so I suppose the first thing was to start with the locally sourced, but that might not be London. It might not even be UK, but you start there and work out until you can settle on something that's not too far. And I think, you know, it was then balancing those factors against sustainable manufacturing, the growing knowledge of suppliers, actually, that, you know, some of them you ring up and you ask them about their sustainable practices or their manufacturing processes and they have no idea. And others, they go, oh, yes, we do lots. Here's our pamphlet, you know, and we're really excited about it. And I think it was quite clear. You could sort of quite easily start that early navigation just by the people that are interested in it. At least are more interested than the ones that are not and have nothing to say yet. So, but you know, then you look at whether it's recycled or biodegradable. Is there something useful on that front? But of course, looking, as I said, about there's a bit of contradiction sometimes between that. Then looking at the circularity of the item and how it might be disposed of at the end of its life as well. There's accreditations that obviously help you cut to the chase with this, as, alongside the kind of usual FSC and PEFC for timbers. And the B Corp is quite useful for looking at people generally with the right approach. But then more specifically on the VOC side, the Green Guard badge was really helpful. So anyone that's already got that is quite helpful. But then there's also an ME code label we discovered where there's EC1 plus is the highest rating of that. So again, anything with that got an immediate fantastic tick in the box. But there's not many that even know about it or test for it or have these things. So, but again, once you're in that sort of group of people that have those badges, then actually they're usually ticking a lot of the other boxes as well, you know, because they're really, really aware of all of the issues that we're talking about. So, you know, in some ways, once you found some suppliers that were really, really on the right path, it sort of, you could source various things from them and actually it could kind of keep the palate fairly calm and collected, but you're going from the sort of suppliers that are all on the same basis. And I would say, you know, so flooring throughout was timber or cork we used, and the sort of eco cork planks, which, you know, were laid as well as the timber, were all laid without adhesive. So they were laid as a floating floor. So that eliminated the adhesive layers. And of course makes it better for removal as well in future because they can just all lift up. Whereas how many projects have you been to where you wonder if you might be able to save the floor, but then every inch of it's glued down and nothing's salvageable.
On the basis then that the most sustainable thing is the thing you already own, I think your clients also had some family furniture and other possessions that they wanted to incorporate into the project. Is that the case? And how did you go about managing those?
Yeah, that was the easy part, really. We do that on a lot of our projects. So we sort of audit at the start what people have got and what they're bringing. And then we sort of design those in as we go, making sure that they work with the layouts that we're doing. The hardest thing was the sofa, actually, because although there are people doing sofas without any foam and without fire retardant treatments and things, it's still pretty specialist. And in the end, to, you know, balance off the size, everybody's tastes, the design, you know, as you know, that can be a very hard thing to choose anyway, a sofa. In the end, the client did settle on a compromise there that it was a little bit more of a mainstream supplier. And, you know, they just accepted that they would, you know, rely on the MVHR and their air purifiers to sort of off-gassed at the start, basically. So that was the one thing that in the end went through a didn't really necessarily tick every box that she wanted, but it was, you know, she was happy to take that compromise.
So this is a really hard question because there are so many amazing aspects to this, but what part of this wonderful project would you say you guys are the most proud of?
Well, we've probably got one each really for that. But I would say for me, it's got to be the journey I think it took us all on, because while it's something that we had definitely done in other projects, we had definitely not done it to the extent of this, where it was from outside and in and with all of these different aspects and different things. So, you know, the whole team really were sort of researching and looking into things. And I think it's broadened everybody's knowledge a lot. And I feel like, you know, there's a lot a lot of way of life stuff as well that was quite interesting to learn from it too.
It's that rigorous approach that Jenny's already spoken about, that being forced to ask the questions, the awkward questions of the suppliers, and learning from that process, being forced to ask about sourcing, about what materials are being used in a particular product, about where they're derived from, about where they're manufactured, where the all those background questions that feed into all those various threads and topics that make up whether something is or isn't sustainable. It's so varied. It's so detailed. It's really, really informative. So I'm really pleased you've been able to pull it all together in such a rigorous way.
What is the best piece of advice you could give to another architect or designer who wanted to undertake such an ambitious project?
Two things. Listen to the client, understand what it is that is important, motivates them when it comes to sustainability. Take them on an educational journey with you as well, but work with specialists. They're out there. They're very talented. They're very good. Bring in a passive house assessor to do those early stage design roles with you. Bring in an energy consultant to model the building and understand what the building fabric needs to be like.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, don't be scared, actually. It's not a difficult thing to do. I think people are so much more aware now. There's a lot more help from suppliers. There's a lot more out there. And in fact, this project stretched over a number of years. And even from the beginning of the project to the end, the process was different. You know, when it came to sourcing the soft furnishings towards the end, it was a much easier journey than from right at the start when we were looking at, you know, early concept for sanitary ware and things like that. And I think, you know, everyone's getting more involved, everyone's getting, you know, more genned up on it. And actually, it is a lot, there's a lot more out there.
And am I right in thinking that this is one of only 12 retrofit homes, passive house homes in London?
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was 9, but maybe they've snuck a couple in since. But yes, exactly, which is really exciting. And again, when you look at most of the others, they are very, you know, sort of lovely but sensible sized houses with sort of sensible principles. And I think this looked to me to be one of the only luxury homes, as it were, that ticks that box as well.
Thank you so much for your time today. That has been the most informative of discussions. We do hope you've enjoyed this episode, and please do get in touch on our social channels at Interior Design Business Pod to share any feedback. The Interior Design Business is Wildwood Plus Production.